Blog Talk Radio.
Can even taste it. My name is Pato Banda.
In that song, I don't even know what the name of that song is. I'm sure Paula can tell me what that is. This is Andre. Go ahead, Paula. I'm sorry. What is
that? That's Pato Banton, and this is My Opinion.
Oh well, you know, that should be my favorite song because you know that's my middle name is Andre Opinion Traversa. That should be. Welcome everyone to the Cosmic Citizen. A great day in Chicago today. You know, I always ask you about the weather. I don't know. We seem to have opposite weather. It's going to be like in the upper 60s here today. What's it like where you are?
Same thing.
Oh, well, great. I guess for the first time we're having some synchronized weather here. But anyway, this is Andre Traversa with Paula Thompson. Welcome again to the Cosmic Citizen. Today we are going to do a couple different things. We're going to have some open phones, which we haven't done for a long time. We're also going to play a speech that was delivered by Charles Olivier, who's a longtime Uranus book reader. I think he's been reading since the late 60s, at least. He delivered a speech at the Fellowship Summer Seminar last summer, the Intensive Study Summer Seminar, and it was a speech. The theme of the conference was God Consciousness, and his particular talk was God Consciousness, God the Father. And so we're going to be playing that shortly for you. And we also are going to be doing open phones. We're taking prayer, which I know is one of Paula's favorite things to do and one of my favorite things to do. We're going to be taking your prayers, prayer requests. If you want to call in and let us pray for you on the air, please feel free to do that. I'm going to give out our phone number right away here, 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. So, Paula, anything on your mind this morning? Any particularly edifying thoughts that you might want to share with everybody?
Oh, Andre, don't put me on the spot.
Oh, I have to. That's my job.
I am drinking my coffee, and so I'm trying to get the juices flowing at this point.
Well, you know, that always you probably went to Starbucks, right?
Yes, I
did. Well, you know, there are some people who would claim, I can't speak for this, but there are some people who would claim that when you drink Starbucks coffee, it gets you closer to God.
Well, you know, my motto is just give me Starbucks and nobody gets hurt.
There you go.
But, yeah, once I do that, then, you know, it starts flowing pretty good. But, yet, you know, it's funny because Saturday mornings are, you know, typically slow until I'm starting to gear up to do the show. And so it was about 8 o'clock this morning, and I got a call from our friend Robert Borello in Miami. And he said, Paula, I'm doing a book fair next weekend, and I need some books. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I don't, you know, the issue is getting them there in time. And but, you know, I just hit the ground running, and I ran upstairs, and I packed a box of 10 softbacks, and I packed a box of, because, you know, there are so many Spanish-speaking people in Miami. I have some When Things Go Wrong, which is a brochure put out by Michael Foundation in Oklahoma City. Not a brochure, it's actually a booklet. And the booklet is, you may be aware of it, it's all wonderful quotes from the Urantia book, very positive and uplifting quotes to help you get through a bad time.
Are they in Spanish?
Yes, and Harry has them translated into Spanish and put them out through Michael Foundation.
Okay.
And so I have a bunch of these books, and I said, look, Robert, I've got a bunch of these great books in Spanish. I'd be happy to send you those. And any other resources I have. I have 21 Steps to a Spiritual Awakening in Spanish. So I packed
wow.
in boxes, ran down to UPS, $137 worth of shipping later. You know, we got it off, and they say he'll get it by Thursday, which is what he asked. So I've already hit the ground running this morning, actually. So my mind was kind of racing in that direction as to, you know, making sure that that the folks in Miami got whatever materials. They already have some books, but it'll be nice for them to have the UVersa Press book as well. And,
well, great, great. That's awesome. And is there a UVersa? There's no UVersa translation in Spanish, is there?
No, there's not, no.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, so I want to, so again, we are going to be, as I said before, anybody, if you want to call in for any reason and talk about anything, you can please feel free to do that. And I don't really have much to say right now. I think maybe I figured, you know, we could get into the speech here shortly, and then we can kind of go from there and maybe use that as a springboard. We can have some discussion. And like I said, if anybody wants any prayer requests, please feel free to call us. You can also email your prayer request.
And you can put on the board, too, guys.
Yes, that's another possibility, too, if you want to put them on the board. Paula is the consummate multitasker, so she is, by some gracious act of God, she is able to pay attention to what we're doing on the air and pay attention to the board at the same time. So I guess it's like walking and chewing gum, but I've actually been told that it's a pretty complicated set of tasks. So, Paula, I got to hand it to you. So. Okay.
Well, I should tell my friends on the board that, you know, if the conversation gets intense, I can't really look at the board a lot of times and so on. And a lot of things happen on that board, Andre. You would be amazed how much goes on that board, and it moves very, very quickly. And we have a lively group on there that comes every single week, and they really have awesome conversations on that board, and it calls you away. Sometimes I find myself looking at the board and thinking, now what did the guest just say?
Sure. Well, you
they
know,
get off on tangents too, and it's interesting. So kudos to all of you on the board. You guys are great multitaskers.
Well, before we get into the speech, I want to also remember now what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to kind of give people an idea as to why we're doing this. One of the things I really would like to do, I have a feeling, and I could be wrong, but I have a feeling that maybe we may have a lot of listeners who are UranceBook readers who may be isolated from other readers. I know that Kevin in Tokyo has not really talked to other readers, except this is his only avenue to talk to other readers. And one of the things that I want to talk to people about, for those of you who have never experienced it, is the incredible joy and the fun you can have. And the incredible high that you get from going to a Urantia Book conference. I it's like nothing I've ever experienced in my life. And Paula, and you've been on the other end of that too. You've been on the preparation side of a Urantia Book conference. I mean, it must have been quite important to you for you to get involved in, you know, in preparing them. I mean, you guys think we have good fellowship here on the air. I mean, it's nothing compared to the kind of fellowship you have with other readers. When you get a bunch of Urantia Book readers all in the same place, you know, several hundred of them, you get all these kindred spirits together. I mean, it's like nothing I've ever experienced. I mean, I can honestly say that you know, the Urantia Book readers are my true family. They are my spiritual family. And when I get together with them, I just feel so much unconditional love and so much intellectual stimulation and so much spiritual stimulation. It's amazing. I'm sure you can testify to that, Paula.
Oh, Andre. You know, to me, and it's just, it is amazing. It's almost transcendental. And the very first conference I ever went to, Urantia Conference, and I could have gone to some before that, but the fate just didn't allow it for whatever reason. But because I've been a reader since 1977, so the very first conference that would have been easy for me to go to was here in Snowmass in 81, and I wanted to go to it. I really wanted to go to it. And my husband back then, he's the one that died in a car crash, he didn't really support me socializing about the Urantia Book. And even though he's the one that turned me onto it, And he didn't want me to go to it, so I just kind of caved on that one and didn't go. But it would have been easy because it's right here in my state. I could have driven there. It would have been, you know, easy to go to. So, and then, you know, the other conferences that were far away during the 80s, I just didn't have the kind of money that it would have taken to get to them. But in 1990, I went to my first Urantia conference in Snowmass again. It was in Snowmass. And I drove our friend Andre Rodada.
But that was your first one?
That was my first one, yeah.
In 1990, wow.
It's the only one
I actually remember meeting you at that one. But that's the first time I ever met you, but I didn't realize that was your first conference. Wow.
That was my first one, and I didn't, it's the only one I haven't had to work the whole conference. But,
wow.
But that's okay, you know, because I love being there. I love being with the readers. I love serving them. And, you know, what's amazing is we've actually identified at Urantia conferences people, when they've been there at the triennial conferences, which we've been doing since the mid-70s, every 3 years, it's like a big family reunion. And Urantia Book readers really do believe we are spiritual kin. I mean, that's, if you read the Urantia Book, you will end up knowing, you will know of a certainty, without a doubt, that every human being on this planet is a brother or sister.
Yes.
And even if they don't know it, even if they don't know it, even if they're your enemy, even if they hate you, even if they're, you know, unlovely, they are your brother and sister in reality, in the greatest of all reality, the supreme reality. They are your brother or sister. We have the same Creator Father. There is just no doubt about it.
And I would also say, I don't want to idealize Urantia Book readers, because they're humans just like everybody else. But I got to tell you, I've never met a group of people, a more loving group of people, a more interesting group of people. And it's really one of the things I think I've talked to you about this before, Paula. One of the things I love about Urantia Book readers is they can disagree without being disagreeable. Now, that's not always true, but a lot of times, you know, if we're talking about some fine point in the book or we're debating politics or whatever, you know, I can still come away with them knowing that that person is my friend. You can even get passionate and have your voices raised, but it doesn't become abusive, or doesn't become, and I just, there's so many, I mean, they are, I can honestly say they're my best friends in the whole world, are Urantia Book readers. And I just really, and the reason I'm bringing all this up is, and the reason we're playing this speech is I want to give people a foretaste, just a little foretaste of what a Urantia conference that we like. And there's no way that we can really duplicate this on the air, but you know, one of the things that happens at this conference is people give speeches. And we're going to be playing this speech today from Charles Olivier. And next time we do this, we're going to play one from Phil Taylor. And I just want people to get just a little bit of a glimpse, just a little bit of a foretaste of what these presentations are like, what these speeches are like. So that's basically why I'm doing it. And I want to give people just sort of a encourage them to consider attending a conference. I know that they can be expensive for some people, but believe me, it's worth it. It really is.
Well, and it is, and I'm glad you're doing it, Andre, because, you know, a lot of thought goes into it. We know that Charles is English or history? He was a high school teacher for many, many years, and very, very accomplished speaker, I think, and easy to listen to. He has an amazing voice. He has a kind of a Dr. Martin Luther King kind of voice, and so, you know, I feel privileged to serve with Charles, and I have to agree with you 100% about Urantia Book readers. You know, we're just humans like anybody else, but we've been touched by an epical revelation, and it changes everything. And it's more than just the intellectual grasp of it, Bro Dave. I saw your comment on the board. It's more than that. You do get it from spiritual insight, that's true, but there's something about that, what that book says, that brings it right home to you. If you were in denial about it before, you probably wouldn't be in denial about it after reading that book. And, you know, I think it's here to save humanity in that way. I often tell people, you know, it's never been about whether or not God loves us, because all of the prophets have said how beloved we are to God. And Jesus, of course, brought that home better than anybody. the lesson humanity hasn't been able to learn is whether or not we love one another.
Mm.
And
mm.
Jesus asks us to love each other with a startling affection. And I've thought about, you know, at least Jesus in the Arantia book. I'm not sure if that's in the Bible or not, but I've thought about that a lot. And what that means, what that ends up meaning to me is it's startling because nobody would expect it. That's what's startling about it. And
I want to I want to know to people that, and I, again, I'm sure you can testify to this. I've experienced that startling affection probably most dynamically and most vividly in my life among your Rancho Book readers. And again, I don't need to idealize them, but I just, you know, I've never been loved by people the way I've been loved by fellow readers.
Yeah. Yeah, I can say that true, Andre. And just the nature of the Urantia book sometimes makes our disagreements real passionate. But I think in the end, we come back to that place of family, which, you know, and it's true, you know, I've come to the conclusion that everybody's definition of how a family would treat each other is different. And what family does and what family means and what brothers and sisters mean and what, you know, affection and startling affection mean, all of those things are subject to each person's interpretation because there is no official interpretation of the Urantia book. And I love that. That's essentially why we're able to disagree and move on because there is no authority, no ultimate authority on these teachings. They're certainly wonderful scholars and people who have amazing understandings and draw deep insights, people like Chris Halverson and Andre Rodatis and, you know, David Kulicki. You know, you could go on all day, our own bro Dave. They study it and study it and study it, and they interpret it, and they look for deeper meanings, and they find them, and they share those with others. But there is no official interpretation of the teachings. And I love that about the Urantia book, because then we meet together in a very informal way, like we are right now on this radio show, like we do in study groups across the country, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Sunday, you know, weekly. And we share those insights with each other, and we all benefit from them. And there's no hierarchy. There's no clergy that's going to tell you, no, this is the way it's interpreted. There's something so beautiful about that that allows you, Andre, or me, or any one of us on this board here, or anyone listening, any listener, you can interpret it however you find in your heart. Whatever it gives you, it gives you.
And yes, and I think, and that's true. And having said that, though, I also think that there's so much I learn from other people's interpretations. And I can, and the thing that's nice about it, though, is you're right. I can learn from other people's interpretations, and I can, but I can also agree or disagree, and I can say, you know, because there's no authority, there's no one telling you this is the, as you said, this is the right way to interpret it. But on the other hand, we also have certain readers who've been reading for a while, and we respect them enough to give them the opportunity to speak to us and to present to us and that kind of thing. So that's what we're going to do here shortly. And should we go ahead and give Charles a roll here?
Charles? You bet.
This is Charles Olivier speaking on God Consciousness at the 2009 Urantia Book Fellowship Intensive Study Seminar.
Did you notice how nimbly I went up those steps? Not bad for an old man. A lot of guys my age have a difficult time doing that, but I'll give you guys a break. I won't mention any names this morning. Of course, all of us should become more nimble in the art of living. But to do that, we have to have Father's grace in our lives, more of it. That's a necessity for all of us. Good morning, Sacred Father. I'll be talking about you this morning. Yes, I'll be talking about you this morning. Sacred, most Sacred Father, beloved, blessed. And I'll be talking about your divine Son, Father, as well. So Michael, would you please keep your spirit of truth a little bit longer among us in this gathering, since there are more than three of us here today. And good morning to all of you and your angelic associates. in this audience this morning. Did you know there are some cultures that routinely, when they greet one another, greet the individual in front of them, but they also greet their angels at the same time? There are some traditions that do that. Rather beautiful tradition. I think it anticipates a certain feature of light and life. And thank you, Barbara, for that warm introduction. I suppose you wouldn't mind coming after Father and Michael. But I appreciate your kindness. According to the Urantia book, the ability to comprehend is the mortal passport to paradise. It's a direct quote from the Divine Counselor. The ability to comprehend is the mortal passport to paradise. So it would appear that the ability to find God depends on our consciousness of Him, and that's the rub. A definition of consciousness that appeals to me is the notion of a, quote, inward awareness of an external object, state, or fact of what is really at stake in modern philosophy. Webster's Third New International Dictionary, my favorite dictionary. If this is extended to God, then the stakes are the highest possible, indeed. But we need not be overawed or intimidated by this, as many people seem to be. The beauty of a celestial revelation is the help it gives to the mortal side of things. The revelatory text in the Urantia book provides the necessary compensation for finite human mind to grasp something of the divinely infinite, and that's a big deal. As a proposition, this generalization is more than reasonable. It's quite attainable, I should say. Our consciousness of God and His consciousness of us are wonderfully, beautifully reciprocal. The Universal Father has even gone so far as to invest in us a perfect fragment of His nature as we make our way back to the source and center of all things and beings. Can you think of anything quite so intimate as indwelling the mind of another? Think about it. Intimate is the right characterization. Our relationship to our thought of justice is as intimate as it possibly can be. What a spectacle it must be to other beings who don't have this. There's every reason to believe and hope. I'll say that again. There's every reason to believe and hope that the pathway of this adventure, which starts in paradise, reaches down to individuals on the planetary shores of inhabited worlds, and then returns to paradise, will actually work. This is the core of our faith, the core of our faith. It is the safe harbor of our spiritual imagination in time and space. Yet the religion of the spirit depends on the content and quality of our mindset. Our ability to discern God depends ultimately on our sense and appreciation of His nature. It's the reciprocity, the harmony, the sensitivity, the intimacy. This is where revelation can come to the aid of evolutionary mind. Here then is my thesis. A truer, higher characterization of God's consciousness ought to assist us in developing a broader, deeper mental and spiritual culture for ourselves. A lot of people do not think of the mind as possessing a mental culture. They should, because it is. Culture can be used in a variety of ways, thought of in a variety of ways, and a spiritual culture, and integrated. Coming, therefore, to a better comprehension of God's nature, potentially, should allow us to achieve a status akin in our personal lives, a status akin in our personal lives to light and life, perhaps closer to what Jesus accomplished. That's realistic. Why wait for the world to evolve? With this as a premise, it may be worthwhile to examine two general features about God presented in the first five papers in the Urantia book. The first feature or dimension consists of his name and what his name implies. We'll speak on that shortly. And the second feature is focused on salient characteristics of his divine nature. These little microphones are kind of short for us tall guys. Confounded machines. I think it is curiously revealing that, quote, the names which, this is divine counsel speaking now, not I, the names which the creature assigns to the creator are much dependent on the creature's concept of the creator. The first Austin Center has never revealed himself by name, only by nature. That's the absolute, first absolute humility. He would have, as Jesus talked in his sermon about why the heathen rage, behave yourself in such a way that others will be drawn to you, so you don't have to go to them with your message. That's the righteous life. Jesus taught that. Well, God demonstrated that, demonstrates that by only revealing his nature, not his name. And we're drawn to him accordingly. That's a model for us as well, to be sure. I would like to suggest to you that the name we pick for God will undoubtedly be qualitatively proportional to the scope and depth of our consciousness of God's nature. Very subtle, very profound, very simple, and yet so far-reaching in possibilities, this relationship, these possibilities, potentialities. Utilizing the advantage given to us through the fifth epochal of Revelation, let us take a look at the myriad of names others in the universe have given to God as a way to enlighten our awareness of him. And as a parenthetical thought, I would point out to you, I use only names that as I reread the five papers and culled these names from the five papers, first five papers. I realize that names are used other papers, but I want that those papers are devoted to Father. Those are very special papers. Nobody else. I use only names in which the first letter of key words were capitalized, sort of giving them the weight of proper nouns. And I have a total of 30. There are a few more, but I stopped at 30. I like the way the two columns looked. I never said I wasn't eccentric. Perhaps even foolish. Well, definitely foolish. Certainly eccentric. Nobody collects angels like I do is not eccentric. But that's not foolish. Images of angels are good medicine. I even put one on my lecture book. Here, I'll hold it up for you and see if you see it. 19th century French. Or very endearing. I have hundreds of these. You'd be amazed how many there are. And they come to you. People bring them to me all the time. And others. The first name is God, of course, most universal. Universal Father, of course. First source and center, first Father, Paradise Father, Creator Father, I Am. Havona Father, Universal Center, Infinite Upholder, Father of Lights, All Powerful One. Oh, I love this list. Supreme Soul. Universal Controller, Original and Eternal Personality. First Source, Creator. It's so wonderful to speak to an audience that appreciates and understands this. I cannot tell you the joy it is to be here. Universal Creator, Eternal and Universal Father, the Eternal, the Infinite, Father of Fathers, Spirit Father, Father of Universes, Divine Controller, Gift of life. How delightful. Amen. Universal disposer. Ancestor of all things. Primal mind. And our Father. This is perhaps the sweetest and most endearing. The divine counselor, the author of these first five papers, is correct in reminding us that the important consideration is for us to get, quote, to know him and aspire to be like him. Yet a name can define, shape, and guide one's consciousness of something or something, someone or something. Native American cultures, you're sometimes given a name, because you've earned a new destiny. Crazy Horse of History, he's one of my, a figure I admire a great deal. Crazy Horse surrendered, but he never surrendered his self-respect and dignity. That's what the army soldiers wrote about him when he rode in. A great man, a noble man, sacrificed his pride, his male pride, to save his children of the tribe, of the clan. His father, when Crazy Horse was about 16 years old, according to one of his biographers, who knew Min, interviewed him in the 1930s, that knew Crazy Horse, they were old enough to know him, said his father gave his name away to his son, and his father was no longer called Crazy Horse. The son was now called Crazy Horse. Names have tremendous power. I've known people to pick names to shape the future development of their sons or daughters. Given our Agandanta circumstances, the predominance of the role of father in that list that I just read, the word father was used over a third of the time, emphasizes the power and grace of fathering in human personality existence. Fathering carries forth an attitude of love and respect that sets no conditions. Its consciousness, fathering that is, its consciousness is revealed as considerably greater than even brotherly or sisterly love. In speaking about the golden rule, Jesus taught that the highest of spiritual level, that on that level we should, quote, treat all men as we conceive God would treat them. That attitude potentially, with the thought adjuster, will save this world yet. Revelation then teaches us that fatherhood is the procreational creature's greatest and most enduring thought picture of the nature of God, that is, our consciousness of Him, and one that ought to shape our attitude toward our fellow creatures. This is the godlike or fatherlike perspective, and it's the perspective that holds the view from above. Another way to say that is spiritual wisdom in contrast to genetic knowledge. And it's the product of celestial thinking and action, that is fathering, as is mothering, of course, as well. In addition to the significance of his name, there is a second general feature of him alluded to earlier, consisting of spirit characteristics of father's divine nature. I've identified 8 spirit characteristics. These are characteristics directly associated with him in the first 5 papers. So as I reread the papers, I also culled and wrote down every single time these characteristics were mentioned, usually as adjectives, were mentioned. They are living values of his perfect, infinite, eternal, universal, and absolute character. In light of his declaration that we should become perfect even as he is perfect, we ought to make every effort to incorporate his virtues into our own character. We should do this wholesome attempt at wholesome discipline by being gentle with ourselves. Thank you, Andre. We agree. It's important. Discipline is important to the development of character, to be sure. And wholesome discipline is very important, but we should be gentle with ourselves at the same time. That's what it's called, balance. Hence the importance of identifying the father's value judgments. They can become, to the best of our ability, a kind of behavioral marker of our consciousness of him and a manifestation as well toward our fellow mortals. As I reread the papers, I counted a number of times these 8 living values of God were mentioned. Using them as a kind of criteria, certain assessments may be offered concerning the potential for shaping human comprehension of our Father deity. Here are the 8 divine facets of our beloved Father, from the most frequently mentioned to the least referenced: love, goodness, wisdom, mercy, righteousness, truth, justice, beauty. I'll say it again. Love, goodness, mercy, I'm sorry, love, goodness, wisdom, mercy, righteousness, truth, justice, beauty. Love was mentioned 69 times. If I missed one or two, either way, it una offset the result. But I did it conscientiously. But I might have missed one. Maybe I didn't. As well, that's a possibility as well. We would. Love was mentioned 69 times, goodness 28 times, wisdom 21 times, mercy 18 times, The Divine Counselor mentions righteousness 16 times in those first five papers, mentions truth 15 times as part of God's nature, justice 12 times, beauty 8 times. Therefore, love, perhaps with no surprise, is the winner. Love, goodness, and mercy make up a total of 115 mentioned in the first five papers by the Divine Counselor in his effort to describe God to us, the nature of God. Yet goodness and mercy added up to 46 do not total more than love. So goodness and mercy together don't total more than love. While mercy is love applied and reflects the presence of goodness, it, mercy that is, requires wisdom, insight, and foresight, hence those four first ones, love, goodness, wisdom, and mercy. Interestingly, the Divine Counselor chose to point to love, goodness, and wisdom, and mercy 136 times, or more than twice the other four characteristics combined, which were righteousness, the second set of four, or the least four, righteousness, truth, justice, and beauty. But I don't want to take this compartmentalization of mine too far, at least you're starting to worry. Some of you who are philosophers would, particularly if you have an Eastern non-dualistic orientation. All of these relative numbers are merely, I appreciate your kindness and graciousness and your humor, your understanding. All of these relative numbers are merely concessions to my time-bound mind, obviously. For instance, all of the Father's love is beautiful, true, and good. Beauty is mentioned 8 times, love 69 times, but all of the Father's love is beautiful. His mercy is righteous, and his justice based entirely on truth. His wisdom beautiful, yet love prevails. So there's an interesting lesson, rather subtle lesson in all that. Taken together, this sequence of 8 perfect virtues profiles our Father's generous character. Here I'm going to reconstruct the characterization paralleling the 8 between from love to beauty. Just another paraphrase. I like to paraphrase. The profiles of our Father's generous character, graciously divine attitude, unerring insight and foresight, forgiving nature, perfectly correct behavior, absolute reality, fairness, and attractive harmony. His consciousness toward his creatures are really better described as, who are better described as his children. We are creatures, but we're really better described as children. It's more to the point, existentially. Experientially. His consciousness is a joy for us to behold toward us and for anybody else to observe us. Still, his love, unfettered, I want to emphasize this again, his love, unfettered and unconditional devotion, such as it is, prevails as the chief feature of his divinely complete and replete nature. And here I'll summarize so far. I would summarize the first five papers in two words, Father's love. The Father's love. That's the first five papers. That's the essence of those papers. A Father's love. Isn't that remarkable? It is not incredible, but it is amazing. It is amazing. James has a song written about that, amazing, I think, at one point. It's a Father's love for sure, combining the primacy of a name with the fundamental value of this singular deity. A Father's love. The identity and character of the Universal Father are indeed reflective of the divine consciousness and can certainly serve us simultaneously as a guide for forming and refining our own consciousness of Him. Then in turn, it becomes the basis of our attitude to the extent that we internalize God's, we can and do and will internalize and act upon, internalize God's virtues. That will then shape our attitude toward those who are behind us in development, on par with us in development, and ahead of us in development, in the supernal ascension scheme of personality perfection. I am most grateful, Sacred Father, for these revelations from on high of your incomparable nature. The Urantia book itself constitutes another demonstration of your providential oversight and affection. An affectionate devotion as you delegate power and grace. I would like to take this opportunity, dear Father, to express some of the range and depth of my appreciation for you, by paraphrasing some of the statements in the Urantia book from those first five papers. A book for me, Father, which is sweet soul music. I've been waiting a number of years to say that to an audience. The Urantia book for me is sweet soul music. For some reason it's important to say it. Sweet soul music, Father. So I come now to worship you, Father, unbidden, in true liberty and joy. You, God, are alone. There is none beside you. You have created the heaven and the heaven of heavens. With all the hosts, you preserve and control them. You cover yourself with light as with a curtain and stretch out the heavens as a curtain. You are the everlasting God who inhabits eternity. You are universal spirit, eternal truth, infinite reality, Father personality. You are the infinite spiritual reality. You are the sovereign, eternal, immortal, and absolutely majestic person. In you we all live and move and have our being. Your understanding is infinite. Your greatness is unsearchable. You do great and marvelous things without number. You are the Lord who changes not, the Father of lights in whom there's no variableness nor shadow of changing. Your counsel shall stand according to your eternal purpose which you placed with your sons. You are righteous and just. Your natural laws wise, and your spiritual mandates righteousness. Your mercy is the logical, inevitable offspring of goodness and love. Thank God Almighty for that. You are the Lord who executes loving kindness in judgment. You are love. Not about love, He is love. Your love is universal, whosoever will may come. You would have all men be saved by coming into the knowledge of this truth. As Jesus told Peter, the enemy might have you, but I would not lose you. You were not willing that any should perish. Lord, have mercy. You are not willing that any should perish. Never forget that. Not only is God who He is, but He loves us with an absolute personal love equally. No conditions. No qualifications. In all our afflictions, You are afflicted with us. I don't know how that's possible, but it is. You are our Father, a real Father, a true Father, the universal Father. Every good gift and every perfect gift comes down from You, the Father of lights. You are the eternal refuge of the souls of Your sons and daughters. You heal the brokenhearted. You bind up the wounds of the sin-sick soul. Lord, You're all-powerful benefactor. As You heal and respond to the cries of the brokenhearted, You know our down-sittings and our uprisings. All things are open to You. You understand what we have need of even before we ask it of You. Ain't it wonderful? You know that we know that You are at hand as well as far off. That is wonderful. That You are ever present and all pervading. That Your Spirit is everlasting and indwells in the mind of every mortal. Because of you and your divine Son, we have a spirit friend and partner within our very heart, a guide toward eternal destiny. There is no power but you, Father, consistent with your divine nature. All things are possible with you. Mm-hmm. You can make a way even when there appears to be to us no way. He can make a way when there's no way. I don't really understand that, but I know it to be true. He can make a way when there's no way. He can make a way. You are absolutely secured and everlastingly enthroned at the paradise source and center of all things as the beneficent Father of all intelligent beings. You are the one God and Father of all, who is above all and in all. You go before all things. In you all good things consist. You are above all and in all, and you go before all things. In you all good things consist. It is a reoccurring wonder to me, dear Father. It is indeed, my friends, brothers and sisters, it is indeed. It is a reoccurring wonder to me, precious Father, that somehow you validate that creature faith which dares to challenge each repeated episode of mortal existence when confronted by the awful spectacle of human limitations, by the unfailing declaration, even if I cannot do this, there lives in me one who can and will do it, a part of you, the Father absolute of the universe of universes, and that is the victory which overcomes the world, even our faith. God bless you.
Well, there you go. That's Charles Olivier giving his insightful, knowledgeable, eloquent, plenary presentation. You got it, with audience reaction and everything. That's just a little taste of what went on at the 2009 summer seminars. There also were workshops that had participants, and it was just a great time of study and fellowship. And you know, again, I can't rave enough about it.
You know, one other word comes to mind, Andre, and that's worshipful.
Yes, yes.
And when Charles started, I say he channels Martin Luther King, because he goes into that mode, that kind of that very dynamic preacher mode.
Yes.
And he's using words from the Urantia book, and it's just so powerful. And everybody on the board got very worshipful during that moment. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
he does that very well too. And
again, to be there in person is just nothing like it. And and what's really great, unfortunately, we're not able to get permission from to play the workshops, because workshops are even more interesting to me, because you have interaction, you have people talking, there are. Unfortunately, we're not able to do that, because we weren't able to get everybody to sign a release form for their workshop to be disseminated and all the rest of it, and everybody, you know. But that's something that hopefully we'll be able to modify, hopefully in the future. I hope that we'll be able to do that, because it would be something that I think would really be worth sharing for people who couldn't make it to the conference.
Andre, I really want to take a minute to just thank you for working so hard on this, to get it so that we could play it today, because it's really powerful and beautiful, and I think anybody would enjoy it. Some plenary speeches at Urantia gatherings have things in them that you'd almost have to be a reader to know what they were talking about, but not so with that one. And that one, I think anybody could benefit from. And
I appreciate your gratitude, Paul. I really do, and that you're very welcome. And I want to say also that that Phil Taylor's, I think, is a lot like that as well.
Yeah.
And so we'll look forward to hearing that as well. And next time we do this, which should probably be in about a month or so. So we'll be playing Phil Taylor's as well. So anyway, why don't we get to again, if anybody wants to call in, you can reach us again at 646-716-8158, 646-716-8158. Maybe you have a comment on what Charles was saying, or maybe you have a prayer request, which is something else we talked about before. We would love to have the opportunity to pray for you. If there's something you want to pray about, we would be more than happy to indulge. Or as I said, maybe you have a comment, or maybe you have something else you want to talk about that's completely unrelated to any of this. It is open phones today, so that means open season, so to speak. Anything is possible here on the Cosmic Citizen. So anybody who wants to chime in and jump in, please feel free.
You know, and reading the board, Andres, during that speech, I heard that speech at the conference and thoroughly enjoyed it there. And so I had a chance to read the board while the speech was playing and watch the reactions to it. And some really wonderful conversations were happening, you know, just spontaneously. Conversations about language and the meaning of language. Our friend Questor in Canada brought up the idea of what is mind. And, gee, you could spend a whole show just on that. And then he started talking about personality, and we talked a little bit about on the board about language and what's the purpose of language. And it was just a real interesting conversation on the board, you guys. So thanks. It was nice to be able to have that 20 minutes to just watch what you were saying. And I know they do this, the discussion board does this every week, and it's always fun. It's always a blast to be able to see it, you know. When we have a guest, it takes more focus. I can't really watch what they're saying because I have to watch the switchboard as well and try to make sense talking to the guest. So you say I'm a good multitasker, but I'm not that good. But anyway.
Well, I think you're just a multitasker because you're a woman and they're just better at it than guys are.
That may be
true. I don't multitask very well myself. So
I think that comes from having children and having had to, women have to deal with children, and so they have to have a child on their hip and do all these other things at the same time. And so I think that's it, probably from eons of time having had to do that, you know.
Wow.
That we become better.
That's a whole other interesting discussion. I think it also could be because I think the other interesting part of that is that I think the brains of women may be more suited for that because you guys have a greater connection between the right and left hemispheres of the brain than men do. It's called a corpus callosum. It's more, there are a more telephone cables, to put it that way, you know, in your brain, so to speak.
Yeah.
Than we have. So, you know, you guys have that. You have that advantage.
Well, and you know, I think what women are more spatial, and men, are space oriented, and men are more time or linear. So.
Right. Right.
We hold a space, and we can have a lot going on in that space at one time, and. Sometimes that makes us distracted, too. So
sure.
There's good and bad in both, I think. And, hey, bravo to that. You know, it's a good plan that that our creators gave us that make us so truly complement one another. And, I love that. I love that about the whole infinite plan of creation and that men need women and women need men. To me, that's bravo on that. I just think that's superb. I think it's superb, and I think most people who aren't involved in a meaningful relationship with the opposite sex or with at least the opposite point of view are busy looking for that.
Yeah, I can testify to that.
I know you can.
So, I'm definitely one of those single guys looking. So
yeah.
Anyway, but.
And anybody out there looking for that, we're praying for you. You know, I've had some really amazing conversations with people who felt like that was never going to happen for them. And I've prayed with them, and I've told them I think it will happen. I think it can happen, and don't give up on that dream. And it has happened. So it's a great human dream to have that partnership. Really.
Well, and it's funny because that's interesting you should say that, Paula, because I find that God, sometimes I hear people say things like, well, God may not give you all that you want, or God, but I actually find that sometimes God gives me everything down to the last detail. Now he hasn't done that yet in the female department, but I know that just in terms of, for example, I had to get some new computer. I had to get a new computer system and a new computer equipment, and I was able to get everything down to the last detail. I don't have to change any of my software. I don't have to do anything. It was just amazing. I didn't think I'd have to do that, because for those of you who don't know, some blind people, including myself, use DOS because it's actually easier for us to use it than it is to mess around with Windows. Now, I'm going to be transitioning into Linux as well, but the point is, I was able to get to continue using my DOS software as well, and I know that's. Some people may think that's just so outdated, but that's really relative, because for blind people it really makes a lot more sense, because DOS is very text-based. And so anyway, the point is that God gave me every single little, down to the last detail, every single little thing that I needed, I was able to keep. So so sometimes God does give us not only everything we want, but more than we even asked for. So.
Yeah, I agree, Andre, When, I think we talked about this, you and I talked about this once, but there's really great value in writing a letter to God and being very specific about what you want. Very, very specific. Did I tell you about this, that I wrote this letter for my daughter, because we were at a women's retreat, a group of Urantian women got together, and talk about a conference, Andre, that's blissful. A group of Urantian women together really nurture and minister to each other. It's just the most incredible thing. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. And I think, when men are not around, women just kind of open their hearts and let themselves be maybe more syrupy than men would like. You know, we really love to share and relate and be together. And so we really open up and minister to each other, and we'll rub each other's backs and neck, and we'll hold each other's hands, and we'll just sit up late at night by candlelight and talk about things and really minister to each other. And we get together and we pray, and just tears flow, and the prayers are so sincere. And it's like, I've had experiences with a group of Urantian women where I felt a vortex in the room, and I felt like everything we said went right up into the circuits. I mean, I felt it. I felt the prayers go right up. It was like astonishing to me to feel the intensity of that. And so my daughter was with me, and she didn't want to write this down. And I said to her, the whole group of us were writing down our prayers, and then we were going to share them together, our requests of God. And the whole idea was to be very, very specific. And I said to her, I'd like to write down your ideal man, if you'll let me. I think I know you well enough to know who that person would be. And she said, okay, you do it. She said, I'd be too embarrassed, but you do it for me. So I did. I wrote this letter to God, and I said, dear God, please bring my beloved child, this person. This is the person she wants. I think I know exactly who she needs, and this is who he is. And I was very, very specific. And, down to, he should like music, the same kind of music as her. But, I was like just very specific. I read it to the group. And, in 2000, she found Jason, her husband. And he is such a sweet, dear, wonderful man. Bright, brilliant, amazing person, and he's the father of my grandson Andy, and they've been married for 5 years now. And I found that letter the other day. I'd saved it. I have this receptacle I call the God Bowl, and a lot of times when I write a prayer down, I put it in the God Bowl, and it's very symbolic for me to just let it go then. I say, okay, Father, I've given you this. You know, even so, may it be, but your will be done. And I put it in the bowl, and I just let it go with all the faith I have. And I found this letter that I wrote the other day, and I read it, and I thought, oh, my gosh. He totally answered that prayer. Totally.
Wow.
I mean, it was just astonishing how what a match he brought for my daughter. And,
that's amazing.
You know, I have a friend, Chris Riggio. You probably remember Chris, Andre.
Oh, sure.
He says, the cosmic waitress took your order.
Did you do that for him, too?
Huh?
Did you do that for him, too?
Well, no, I didn't. I don't feel like I know any, you know, I know just, a, I mean, most people would have to do that for themselves. It's not something that,
sure.
You know, but I know her so well.
Right.
And
right.
She agreed, you go ahead and do it, Mom. And so
wow. We
read it at this Urantia Women's Retreat, and that is when at that very moment when we were reading those prayers, we all went off by ourselves for a while and wrote these prayers, and then came back and read them. And it was at that time where I felt this vortex in the room, and I felt like they were just going right up into the spiritual circuits, just being sucked right up. It was.
I don't know this women's thing. You're giving a lot of information that I probably shouldn't know. You know, it's all this very intimate stuff.
Well, you know, I don't think it isn't really intimate. It's just the way women are, and I think last week I made the comment: women are the heart of ministry. You know, the Urantia book refers to the mother of the universe as the divine minister, right?
Yes.
And ministry is an action, and the third source and center is the conjoint actor. And ministry is very active, very proactive, and women are in that vein where the feminine, you know, it's like the angels are the outworking of the divine minister. They go out into the universes and minister to God's children. Women are a lot like that. And so when we feel comfortable, and obviously we feel more comfortable doing that when there are no men around, because men are kind of uncomfortable with it. It's like my husband, Glenn, you know, I'll say to him, well, we're going to a Urantia gathering. Do you want to go? And he'll say, oh, are we going to share and relate? Because if we're going to share and relate, I don't think so.
Well, I guess I'm weird because that's exactly what I want to do. Like, I don't like it when it's just strictly it's strictly an intellectual thing. There's no sharing and relate. Not that, don't get me wrong, I like the intellectual stuff too, but you know, I like a more balanced you know approach where you do share and relate as well.
Well, I excuse me, Andrea, I do too. But then I'm a woman, and
right.
But I find that a lot of Urantia brothers are very comfortable with that, you know. They have no problem with that.
Well, doesn't it say, it says in the book, too, that it's a great error to teach men that I can't remember how they put it, but it's a great error. I think it's in the Sermon on the Mount paper. They talk about it's a great error to teach men that they shouldn't be sensitive to other people's feelings and they shouldn't be sympathetic. And I don't remember exactly how they put it. I just remember where it says it's a great error that, you know. That's all I remember. You probably could find the quote because you're very good at that.
Okay, I got it. And you're
all right.
Great. This is a great section too because it's from the you were right on. You have an amazing memory, really, for where things are in the book. It is from the Ordination of the Twelve, which is what we know is the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus said, "Happy are they who mourn, for they shall be comforted." And the midwayers give us this commentary, and their commentary, I find, is just invaluable for many reasons, but the most of which is because they've been on this planet with us forever, and they know us better than anybody. And so when they tell us something, they really have an insight into what we need to know, and they give us this commentary right after Jesus, that teaching, then the midwayers tell us this. They say, so-called common sense or the best of logic would never suggest that happiness could be derived from mourning. But Jesus did not refer to outward or ostentatious mourning. He alluded to an emotional attitude of tender-heartedness.
Yes.
It is a great error to teach boys and young men that it is unmanly to show tenderness or otherwise to give evidence of emotional feeling or physical suffering. Sympathy is a worthy attribute of the male as well as the female. It is not necessary to be calloused in order to be manly. This is the wrong way to create courageous men. The world's great men have not been afraid to mourn. Moses, the mourner, was a greater man than either Samson or Goliath. Moses was a superb leader, but he was also a man of meekness. Being sensitive and responsive to human need creates genuine and lasting happiness. While such kindly attitudes safeguard the soul from the destructive influences of anger, hate, and suspicion.
You know what's really amazing about that, Paula? Think about when that was written. Think about how ahead of its time that was. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that people have only been saying recently, you know, over the last 20 or 30 years, you know, with the men's movement, I think it's interesting they mentioned that about Moses because I hear a lot of Christians are now saying the same kind of thing. They're saying, you know, look at, you know, if you look at the Bible, I mean, people wept in the Bible, not just Jesus. You have people, you know, who were, you know, who would cry out to God in their grief. I mean, one reason I think that we have the Psalms is because in the Psalms you hear people complaining, you hear people, you hear David wishing that, praying to God that his enemies be killed. And I'm not suggesting that we should do that. Like, the point of making it all that is simply, I think the Psalms are a comfort because they're basically there to say, you know what, even these people who were, you know, who loved God just the way you do, they have the same human emotions that you do. And, there's one psalm, I think it's Psalm 88, that doesn't even mention God. It just mentions, you know, it just talks about darkness and despair. And to me, I love that, though, because what it says is, it says, again, even these people who really loved God and were seeking God, you know, they felt the same emotions I feel. They know what it's like to be upset. They know what it's like to be depressed. To say that somehow, you know, we should be immune to that, we should be immune to sadness or immune to mourning is just ridiculous. I mean, this idea that somehow, you know, if you're a follower of Jesus, then you've got to be, you know, happy, happy, joy, joy all the time, and you can never be, you know, I don't think that's true, because even, you know, now Jesus was not, we don't want to be morbid about Jesus, but Jesus also was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. So I believe Jesus felt the full range of human emotion.
Oh, without a doubt. And one of the things that makes Jesus so appealing is that very thing, you know. I love that quote that I read simply because it's so true. You look at the great leaders in human history, the male leaders, they've had that quality that is, you know, identified in that quote, in that teaching from the midwares. And people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King were very much attached to humanity, to feeling the pain of others, to having that sympathy for the human condition and what humans were going through.
Sure.
And I absolutely agree with that quote. That is what a courageous man is. You know, that is what courage is. Courage is feeling what is going on.
Being willing to feel, and being, you know, not being afraid to feel.
Right. Not avoiding it, not denying it, not trying to drink it away, not getting angry about it, but allowing yourself to go through it and feel it. That's courage, you know.
Absolutely. And I think it's also courage. You know, I'm sure that a lot of women in the audience agree with this too, because I've heard that that the what is it the people say the three most important words in a marriage are not "I love you," but "I was wrong."
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's another thing. I think that it takes a lot of courage for a man to admit he's wrong. I mean, I grew up with a father who just would never admit it. You know, there's a whole generation of people like that, especially men, not only men, but especially men a lot, I think, who just were taught to never admit they were wrong about anything.
Well, you know,
or if they were wrong, they didn't want to show it. They didn't want to publicly admit it. They might, you know, realize it privately. But
I have come to the place where, in a way, I see that our culture, especially Western culture, is very hard on men, and you know, it expects them to stifle their emotions to the point that, you know, I think one of the reasons why they have heart attacks a lot, because you just can't stuff that emotion back down into your heart. You have to let it be expressed to some, you know, women, when we are sad and we cry, we feel so much better. And I think the Creator gave us that, and I'm not insinuating that people should be crybabies at all. I'm saying that, you know, on the rare occasions when your heart is so full of emotion that the water just comes up, it just bubbles up and comes out your eyes. It's almost like the heart is a well of living water. And I think I said this at the summer seminar, and you know, you were there. I couldn't get through that story without crying because there's so much emotion in that story for me. The story I shared about Jesus and the feast that he prepared for me.
Yes, I remember that.
And that there's so much emotion there when you share at that level, or when you feel that, you have to express it. And to hold that back, I can't even imagine how a person can do that. You notice that Charles Olivier shared his experience with Jesus, and he got emotional. Sometimes for me, I just think about Jesus, and I get
emotional. Well, I think it's funny you should say all this, Paul, because I've had arguments with certain Urantia book readers who seem to think that I actually remember one saying that we should never, that emotion was always bad. I don't know how she got that from reading the Urantia book. I guess there's some place in there where they talk about how it's the mind of perfect poise and balanced neural energies that, you know, that is most, you know, accessible to God. Well, sure. I mean, I don't think we should let our emotions control us. We want to make sure that our expression of our emotion is controlled. But that doesn't mean, but usually that happens when we stuff it. You know, it's like you were saying, when you stuff that emotion, that's usually when it really, it ends up bursting out in toxic ways.
Well, yeah, you're right. And what did that quote say at the end? It said, you know, it safeguards the soul from the destructive influences of anger, hate, and suspicion.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that, you know, if you allow yourself to express what you're feeling, you know, and it doesn't have to be a negative thing. It can be, oh my God, I love you so much.
Right. And, you know, I'm really glad, by the way, this is kind of a different subject, but I'm really glad they say the word suspicion because, you know, I've been accused of people of being too trusting. And maybe I have been too trusting. Of course, I've talked about this, I think, on the air before. I have to be trusting as a blind person because I have to, you know, I have to ask strangers where things are and all kinds of things. But you know, and I don't want to be naive, but I, my goal is to be prudent, not to be suspicious, because I think sometimes people think being suspicious is a virtue. Like, well, you're not supposed to trust anybody. I've heard people say that, you know, someone is too trusting, but I almost never hear anybody say someone is too distrusting or too suspicious. It's almost like in our culture we think that that's a virtue to be suspicious, and I'm really glad that the midwayers talk about that as being a negative thing, because I don't want to ever get to the point where I just don't trust anybody. I don't see how that's productive in any way.
Oh, you mean, well, suspicion? I know. Suspicion is, I think, the Urantia book listed as a spirit poison.
Right. What I'm saying though is, I think, unfortunately, I think our culture almost values it, because I very rarely hear people say, well, I hear people say he's too trusting, but I very rarely hear people say he's too suspicious or he doesn't trust enough. You know, I think our culture almost seems to think that suspicion is a virtue, because if you're suspicious, then, or if you don't trust, then you won't get hurt. You know.
Well, yeah, you won't get hurt. You won't get taken advantage of, and you know,
right.
Really, our culture is detrimental in some ways. Like, you know, we brandy about slogans and sayings like "never give a sec" or "an even break."
Yeah. Yeah.
And it creates an underlying tone of, you know, or another good one, a fool and his money are soon parted. Okay, so does that give you permission then to take advantage of people, to steal from trusting individuals? I mean, we know that the elderly are very susceptible to this, and I think it's generational. I really do. I think that generation is much more trusting than our generation was. And these people call them on the phone and they tell them they're this and that, and they just naturally want to believe that people are good and nobody would want to take advantage of them.
Right, and I think where Jesus gives us the balance is Jesus was trusting, but he was prudent. He wasn't suspicious, he was just prudent. And I think, you know, prudence is just that's the virtue that kind of helps you scope out the territory before you jump in, you know, but it doesn't mean that you never jump in. It just means you scope out the territory, you decide whether this is something you want to invest in or not, and if it is, then you do it, and if it's not, then you go for something else.
Right, right, and you know, you hate to think that people would have to be on guard all the time. I mean, we talk about things like that as being street smart. You're street smart. You don't
right.
trust anybody. Well, you know. The way I look at it is, you know, if you're trying to be like Jesus, and you're trying to be as wise as a serpent but gentle as a dove, you know, I'd rather be like that. So if a person can pull one over on me, gee, I bet they're real proud, you know?
Right.
But I'm not going to change who I am. I'd still rather be a trusting soul and believe in the best of humanity, then be so calloused and so cynical that I won't give anyone a chance, you know? Because I find in my life very few people want to take advantage of you, you know? They're the exception, not the norm.
Yeah, I think that it's funny you mentioned, I think the thing I like most about Jesus, as we're talking about that, about being like Jesus, is I love the fact that he was so balanced. You know, he never went from one extreme to the other. You know, he wasn't bland or boring or you know, he was passionate, but he never, you know, he just never went, but he never went to any extremes. And one of the things that I love is there's another quote in the book that I love where it talks about how, you know, how Jesus would tell stories to the kids, and they would say, "Uncle Joshua, tell us another big story." And it talks about how he could swing from the discussion of politics and current events, you know, or philosophy, and, you know, and then he'd swing from that to go play with a child, you know. And I just thought that was just great. I mean, and actually, I have to say, you know, I don't mean to be arrogant in any way, but that's actually one way in which I think I'm most like Jesus, because that's something I actually am able to do. I really can do that. I can talk one minute, I can talk philosophy and theology, and then the next minute I can play with a child. In fact, it's funny because I remember speaking with our speaker, Charles Olivier, in Flagstaff in 1996, and he and I were having a very serious, intense discussion, and all of a sudden some little children came up to me and just were showing their appreciation for me, and it was just so great because it made me feel so much like Jesus, you know.
And you know, the fact that that's something about the Master too, Andre, that I dearly love, is this idea that he would stop a profound discourse to go and minister to the needs of a single individual, even a little child.
Right.
Which tells you what his priority was.
Exactly. And his priority really was, and his priority, what was his priority? His priority was relationships.
It was relationships, and it was the human need that was greatest. And there's a quote from the book that I absolutely love, and I'll just paraphrase it, but it just is so moving to me. It says, "The greater the love need in any creature, the more divine love seeks to fill that need."
Wow. And, where, do you know what part of the book that's in?
I can find it. Hold on.
That is a great quote.
Because to me, that's a divine attitude, and that's a God attitude, you know.
Yeah, it sure is.
And
wow, that says it all. I mean, that to me is, you know, I mean, how can, once you say that, if you can't, you can't, you can no longer then start talking about God being judgmental or angry or wrathful. I mean, God's only real motive is to love.
Yeah, yeah. Hold on, let me see if I can find it. Sometimes, you know, the key words, you got to get them in the right.
Right.
Let's see. Maybe I have it here. Uh-huh. Well, guess what? Divine love comes up 27 times in the answer. Which is great. Maybe Lou can find it for us. It's such a beautiful quote, and for me, it just it speaks about, you know, about what you were just talking about, and that is being willing to stop what you're doing or whatever your busy day has involved, and minister to a human who's in need. And for hey, somebody on the board just told me Lou already did find it, Paula. Let's see if I can see where you found it, Lou. Hold on. Sometimes the board is not easy to... Oh, okay, here it is. It says, human love. This is from Lou. Thanks, Lou. Let me see if I can get it again. Human love may indeed be reciprocal, but divine love is outgoing in all of its satisfaction seeking. The less of the love in any creature's nature, the greater the love need, and the more does divine love seek to satisfy such need.
Wow.
Love is never self-seeking. And it goes on from there. And, you know, which tells you that, you know, I mean, if you watch a mother with, say, triplets, and she's got three babies, and two of them are happy, they're fine, they're content, and one is crying, which one does she focus on?
Well, she does what Jesus would do. She what Jesus says the Father does. She'll go out and, you know, she'll leave the 99 and go out in search of the lost one. That's basically what's going on there.
That is exactly it, Andre. I think that's it.
Yeah.
And that's us. We're the lost one.
Well,
and Jesus, you know, I love to tell Christians, Jesus didn't come here to save us from God. He came here to save us for God. It's a subtle distinction, but it makes a world of difference.
And, you know, the other thing is I was saying this to Phyllis Tickle when we had her on the air a couple of weeks ago, and she didn't personally really agree with me on this, but I think, you know, when Jesus uses, I think one of the problems a lot of Christians have is they equate the word lost with the word damned. You know, when it says Jesus came to seek and to save the lost, it doesn't mean he came to seek and to save the damned or those who are being damned. It just means we're all God's children, and sometimes we wander away, and he's there to pick us up and bring us back. You know, but it wasn't like we stopped being God's children when we got lost, or that, you know, getting lost and being damned are not the same thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I mean, lost means, I mean, when a child gets lost, nobody would blame the child.
Exactly.
You know, children get lost. And they don't know, they lose their bearings and they don't know where they are. They wander off thoughtlessly, foolishly.
Right.
And then, you know, they get lost. And what parent would be mad at the child for getting lost?
Have you ever stopped to ask yourself, Paula, how, and this is, it's so interesting, you know, how Jesus uses all these analogies from the material world, like whether it's from gardening or whether it's from parenting. It's almost like the material world, like all the things in the material world are deliberately there to serve as analogies to the spiritual world. You know, it's like there's so many things that you can use from the material world as an analogy. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like that's that's why we have the material world, is because it's a way for us to understand, you know, on a very basic level, some of the things in spiritual reality.
Yeah. Absolutely, Andre.
So we have any calls yet?
Hey, you guys, come on. Here's our number, 646-716-8158. This is your chance to call in and say whatever you like.
You're putting us to the test. We're being forced to ramble forever here. We need some direction here. We need someone to call us and kick us in the butt a little bit here this morning. So
this is your chance to complain.
That's right. Yeah. Hey, you know what? You want to complain about the show? That, you know, I never actually invited anybody to do that. If anything you want to complain about, you should call us. Complain. Oh my gosh. I hear so much stuff through the grapevine. You can always tell me directly what's wrong with the Cosmic Citizen. Tell us what's wrong with that show.
Here's your chance.
That's right.
Speak now or forever hold your peace. Tell us what you don't like.
Oh, my gosh.
That clicking in the background, in case you wondered, is my grandson Andy playing with a toy, so I will shut the door.
Okay.
He's so cute. It's hard to resist.
Yes, yes. I remember he liked playing in the bathtub. I remember when I was at your house, he liked that. I think he wanted to know if I wanted to play with his bath toys. So from what I remember, he was And you know, you're right, by the way, about your daughter's husband Jason. He's a great guy and he's a great father. I remember him giving Andy some hot water because his water was getting cold.
Oh, in the tub?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Andre came and spent Christmas with us last year at my house, and he got to know my family pretty well, and we got to know him. And it was such a pleasure, Andre, to have you here.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. You amaze me. The things that you're able to do, just, you know, because being a sighted person, it's amazing to me how anybody gets along without eyesight. And you are a remarkable person. You immediately oriented to my house. I was worried about you coming because I had so many stairs, and you had no problem with anything. You just really amazed me, Andre. And taking you to the airport was the most amazing thing. And really thinking about how, you know, because it's stressful to fly. Airports are stressful to me. And maybe it's because I can see.
Yeah, I think it probably is, because I don't feel stressed at all when I go to the airport.
Really?
No, not even a little bit. In fact, they've actually even managed to get the security down to where it's actually... as long as I get someone, you know, a SkyCap or whatever, someone to take me around, I usually can get through security and everything in about half an hour now. So it's not too bad. I've been able to, you know, I usually have plenty of time to kill before a flight. So.
Okay, well, guess what? We have a caller.
Oh, good.
Our plea worked. It's Kevin, I hear. Is this Kevin? Kevin, is it you?
Well, if I'm the call, this is Lee from Kansas City.
Oh, it's Lee.
Hi, Lee.
And Kevin.
Hey.
I didn't think Kevin was an 816.
No, but if Kevin was ahead of me, I'd want him to go first because I think it's great when he calls in.
He hasn't called yet, so, and I could put you both through. So that's great. Hey, how are you, Lee?
Oh, I'm great, and I want you both to know that you're not, you know, when you two visit, you get into some really good stuff, so never think that you're, you know, you're sort of wasting time because you're not. It's always really deep, I think.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. No, I'm serious about that. Now, since you invited people, I thought, oh, good, I'm going to take advantage of this because in about a month, I am presenting to the Heart of America Society on the kinds of roles that men and women naturally contribute to the universe due to sex differentiation. And I thought, well, maybe you two could sort of hash that over with me to kind of get me kickstarted. I feel like I could find that in the Urantia book for myself as far as women, but I can't find any men who want to do the male half.
Huh.
So far, Lou on the board said he'd help me. I don't think he's going to fly in for the presentation, though.
You know, this gives me an opportunity, Lee. I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. It gives me an opportunity to get on a little soapbox here, because one thing that really frustrates me, and I'm glad you said something I really, really agree with. You said that the roles that men and women naturally contribute to due to sex differentiation. There are people today, you can find them in a lot of universities in particular, maybe in women's studies departments and in a certain feminist, not all feminists, but some feminists, unfortunately, who seem to think that there are no differences between the sexes, that, you know, gender is just a socially constructed myth and it really doesn't exist. And unfortunately, you know, I just read about a professor in California who came out with a study saying that women are more prone to depression, that it's biological, and the women's studies department at the university just got, you know, furious with them and said, you know, how dare you say such a thing? You know, I don't know if you remember some years back, Larry Summers from Harvard said the same thing. He said that men are more likely to go into math and science than women because of brain differences. Oh, he got, you know, he was forced to resign as president. But the reason that it's funny you mentioned this, because I just read something in the newspaper, and this is something that just kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm really digressing, but this is something I thought was really annoying. There was a guy, I guess because of the recession, people are having to make adjustments. And there was a guy who you know, was unemployed, and his wife was a stay-at-home mom. And because he was unemployed, he started, you know, helping her around the house, which is fine. And then she got a part-time job. And then he eventually got a job, but she still was working part-time for whatever reason. Maybe she needed to. I don't know. But anyway, what ended up happening is, you know, he wasn't used to doing, you know, the stuff around the house. So he said to her, he said, well, you know, how can I help? You know, and her response was, well, I shouldn't have to think for you. You know, which I thought was just really, I hate to use this word on the air, but I thought it was really kind of bitchy for her to say it that way. I thought it was like, you know, I mean, I would think she'd be glad that he'd want to help, you know. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, was she expecting, you know, him to be like a woman? Or, I mean, and you can even take gender out of it. Maybe he wasn't used to doing stuff around the house. You know, and so I just thought it was kind of, it seemed very high maintenance to me. And I just kind of wondered if you guys, I mean, this, I guess this kind of stuff is pretty common when men and women, you know, get together and they have these kind of misunderstandings. But,
well, it was a misunderstanding because, you know, as a female, if it's obvious to you, it's easy to assume it would be obvious to a male if you don't recognize that males are you know, wired differently. Not just in their genitals, but in their whole orientation.
Absolutely.
That's one of the greatest mistakes women make, is they assume that a man knows what they're thinking or what.
Yep.
And I have heard women say, if you don't know, I'm sure not going to tell you. Well, that's the best reason I can think of to tell somebody something, is when they don't know. And, you
exactly.
know, The responsibility for communicating how we're feeling and how that feels for me as a woman, you know, it rests upon both men and women to say, you know what, that's not my bag. I mean, I'm just not interested in that. So that women know, you can't force him to go to the opera if he's not interested in that.
Right.
Why would you want to do that? You know, do something that you both like to do, and then, you know, my husband is never going to go get me to sleep in a tent with him while he goes elk hunting. I'm not interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
But he loves it.
Right.
So I'm happy to let him go do that. There's plenty of things we can do that we both like.
Yeah, I really agree with what you're saying, because it'd be so easy, Paula, for you or anybody to say, well, that's selfish. He should do what I want him to do. You know, I mean, I can just see someone saying, but I'm just so glad that you're saying this, because I think it really minimizes conflict, and I think it shows a lot of maturity on your part too, that you're not expecting him to do everything you do as well.
Well, you know, Andre, I don't think I'd be married for 25 years if I, for 26 now, actually, if I was into forcing anybody to do something against their will. And I think you certainly have to find a happy medium and compromise. And I think what really makes relationships work is just core value similarities.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
They are the same things. And but you know, okay. we get off on the tangent of men and women a lot, and it's probably a good thing because it's always relevant. You know, Lee, I think one of the best I've seen some interesting studies on just what you're talking about, how boys and girls are hardwired differently from birth. And they've researched this, and they've found some very interesting things. They've done tests on children, like 15-month-old boys and 15-month-old girls, and they'll put them in the same exact situation, and invariably they react exactly different to the situation. And so they've found out that, you know, and something that Chris Halverson and I got into a wonderful conversation about the differences between men and women once, and I told him, I said, I think we're patterned after we live in a dual origin universe. We have a mother and father in this universe. We have Michael, our creator father, our universal creator, as the father, and we have the divine mother, some call her Nebadonia or Nebadonna, but she defines the space, which is our universe. We're actually in her. We're in her. She's like a cosmic womb.
I love the
pattern you find. We're in her space. She contains us. She is everywhere present in the space of this universe. And Michael, the father, is the time. He holds the time. She holds space. He holds time. So Chris and I were kind of exploring that. And I said, you know, it makes sense to me that women, and this goes back to what you were saying, Andre, about how women can get more depressed. I think you're absolutely right. In my experience, that's true. Because when something traumatic happens to a woman, it's very hard for her to get that out of her space. It's like it becomes a part of her. That trauma is in her space. Where can she go to get that out? And Chris's comment, and I made that comment to Chris, and he said, a good father will help his daughter learn to transcend that hurt and move beyond it. Yeah, that was my expression exactly, Lee. I went, oh, wow. Mm-hmm. And that makes perfect sense. I had a wonderful father. And he really was able to help me learn how to transcend my hurts, which would explain why when he died it was the biggest hurt of my life, because I couldn't see how anybody else was going to help me do that, you know. We have another caller. Hold on, guys. 859, you're on Cosmic Citizen.
Hi, good morning, everybody. This is Kevin from Tokyo.
Hey, hello, Kevin.
Yay!
Hi. Hi. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Good morning, Aaron. Good morning, everybody in the chat room. And it's not a complaint, but I really want to call. And you know, I just want to say that you guys do a really, really wonderful job each and every week. You know, to produce the radio show, and of course, I stay up for it every week, and it's almost, well, it's going on 4 o'clock a.m. in the morning here, so that speaks a little bit about my, you know, my dedication.
No kidding.
You know, stay up for it.
Wow.
Yeah.
I really
enjoy, especially you know, shows like today, for example, you know, and just hearing the recording from the conference, and that, you know, that meant a lot. That was really, really moving, and to me that's really, really so helpful to me. And this is one of the ways for me, especially for me, because I live, you know, way over here in Japan, of course, and this gives me a very great opportunity, you know, from across the ocean to learn, you know, so much from other readers and to connect to other readers. And you know, it's been one of the ways that, you know, I can make, you know, a deeper connection with readers and get to know them. And, you know, of course, we're here every week. Myself, Larry, and of course, Ann, we meet here every week. Brother Dave also, every Wednesday. So I do just want to, you know, say everybody in the chat room, you're welcome, you know, to join us every week. Your Wednesday every week. I think it's 8 a.m. your time.
Well, Central. it depends on what time zone you're in America. I don't know what
time. That's Central time, Andre.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah,
it's
Central.
I'm Central.
You know, Kevin, let me ask you. I've never really gotten a chance to talk to you this much directly. Are you Japanese yourself?
No. I'm strictly. Well, actually, I'm half German. Actually, my father.
You don't sound like you're from America.
Yeah. I'm from Kentucky, actually.
Really? But you seem to have developed a little bit of a Japanese accent. You don't sound American at all. That's very interesting. I know you've been in Japan for like 20 years. I think you told me. That's really. So tell us how you found the Urantia book. Did you find it through our show? Is that how you found it?
No, actually. You know, it's funny because I'd been searching for a long time. I felt, you know, personally for me, I felt there was a greater truth out there than what I had. I came from, you know, I came from a Christian background, and I'm not going to bring an axe, you know, to grind or anything against the Bible or against, you know, Christianity, but just for me, I wasn't satisfied with the theology.
Right.
Of traditional Christianity, and I had a lot of questions that, you know, Christianity and that the Bible itself, you know, it couldn't answer my questions. For every answer that someone would give me, then I had another question for that answer, you know. So I've been searching for quite a while, and I went off into, you know, Buddhism, and I studied Buddhism a little bit, and then I left Buddhism, and I finally came back to God, so to speak. But I was searching, and I was searching basically on the internet, and there was a link that I clicked on. There was a link to the toothbook.com website, and it said something like the 2,000-year-old secret of Christ is finally revealed, or learn about Jesus, the true story of Jesus in the Urantia book. So I was curious, and I clicked on the link, and the rest is, it's history from there.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Now, which site did you click on, Kevin? Truthbook?
I started out with Truthbook, and I found, you know, the book there through Truthbook, and I didn't know anything about it, so I headed over to Amazon, and I went to look up what this book was on Amazon.com, so I went over there, and I found all these amazing reader reviews that people had written about, you know, the Urantia book, and there was close to 100 different reviews on there, and the thing that just really grabbed my attention, I couldn't find anything negative about this, and I thought, wow, that is amazing. Almost just out of like 100 people, I couldn't find a single review that was negative, and I thought, man, I've never seen a book like that with that many reviews, and, you know, everything is, you know, absolutely positive. So I didn't purchase it right away. I was curious, and for a long time, a couple of months, I just read it right off the internet, you know, off of truth.com. And then finally I told myself, okay, I'm going to order this book. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to order this book. So I finally ordered my own copy from Amazon. So, and the rest is history. And then I found Paula. Well, actually, I found some videos on YouTube. And one of the first videos that I found on YouTube, actually, Andre, was one of the introductory videos about the Urantia book. And I found Paula, of course, and Paula was giving her testimony on there, which was quite moving. And then also Andre was on the same video. So then from there, I forgot how I found the radio show, I think, but I think I just Googled it, and then I found the radio show that came up, and the rest is history. So this is really, it has changed my life.
Wow. And Kevin, and let me ask you, what keeps you in Japan? Are you on Japan? Are you in Japan on business? Are you in the armed services or?
Well, I was here prior in the United States military, and I was here for several years in the military. And then I got out of the military, actually, and I came back home, and I was applying for a government position. And so I had to fly up to the Pentagon for this interview that they had up there. So I went up to the Pentagon, and I had my interview, and the guy tells me, he said, yeah, we have a job for you, but it's back in Japan. So he asked me, he said, we would like you to go back to Japan. So, of course, I heard that, and I was like, yeah, no problem. So, 2 weeks later, here I was back on the plane, and, I flew right back over. And I've been here ever since, and I'm not in the military anymore, but I work for an international logistics company. And the headquarters of my company, it's here in Japan. But mostly it's in Asia, China, Hong Kong, a couple down in Singapore, one office over in Waikiki, I think. But it's a logistics company.
Is it pretty cold? Is it pretty cold in Tokyo?
It's getting cold. The days are still pretty nice. We're up in the 70s, like in the daytime, but
it gets cold in the
evenings.
It gets cold in the winter, doesn't it?
It gets cold, but where I am near Tokyo, just outside of Tokyo, it doesn't snow here.
Oh wow!
So we don't get snow. Yeah, so it's
Is it all of Japan like that, or just Tokyo?
No, it's just basically in Tokyo because.
Okay.
We're close to Okinawa, which is close to the equator, actually, so it's a little bit too warm for, for snow.
Wow.
But northern Japan, yeah, it gets, really, really cold, and they get a lot of snow up there, and, in the northern parts. But from my house, I have a... Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
We have a question on the board, if you speak Japanese.
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. I do speak Japanese. I'm fluent in Japanese. So. Of course, I speak a little bit of German as well, and then Japanese. So
say a little prayer for us in Japanese, Kevin.
Let me see. What can I say? Well, 神様は皆様にあなたのご本尊には皆の親戚と命をとても大切にしわししてと見てください。So in English, what I basically said is, give everybody, all the readers that are in the room, the wisdom and the strength to have their eyes focused on you and just watch over us. And protect us, and really let us feel your spirit through our thought adjusters.
Wow.
Now, you see, Kevin, I don't speak Japanese, but I felt the spirit. I felt the spirit on your prayer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, it's something that, believe it or not, when 9/11 happened, I learned this lesson the hard way. And it's not that I didn't. It's just something I never thought of, really. But I had a good friend. The day that 9/11 happened, I was on my way to work when I went into a coffee shop to get my cup of coffee, and I saw the planes hitting the towers. And of course, as it was all America, I was stunned. And I drove to work stunned. And the things that I saw on the way to work were amazing. I saw people stopped in the middle of the street just bawling. Just stopped. Their car just stopped in the middle of the road crying. Just overcome with emotion. And I went ahead and went to work, but I was just stunned all day. And that day, my dear friend Svetlana Brachienya was coming. She's Lithuanian, and she was coming to visit. And she, of course, speaks her first language is Lithuanian and then Russian and English. And so Svetlana got there, and we were both stunned together. And then, lo and behold, Diane Lebrecht calls from Montreal. So I had Svetlana, myself, and Diane, and we put Diane on speaker, and we were so overcome with emotion, and Diane was like, Paul, I don't know what to say. I'm just so overwhelmed. And I said, why don't we pray together? And I said, Diane, you pray in French, I'll pray in English, and Svetlana will pray in Lithuanian. So we put Diane on speakerphone, and I started out, and I said the first prayer, and then Diane prayed in French, and then Svetlana prayed in Lithuanian, and tears were just streaming down all of our faces, you know? We couldn't see Diane, but you could feel the emotion she was expressing. And it's very powerful to, you know, because earlier, I think this is relevant, you guys, earlier we were talking on the board about language, and, you know, the Urantia book tells us that someday when we all speak a common language, that will be one of the main things that will bring about world peace, because it'll bring about true understanding. And we have to get over that hump now, and it's not going to be an easy thing to do, but I feel like you can listen to the spirit of the words, even though you don't hear the words. It's like the Urantia book tells us God hears the soul's attitude. The words are irrelevant. God hears the attitude of the prayer, the soul's attitude. And that's what I felt in your prayer, Kevin. And when Diane called and Svetlana, and they prayed that day at 9/11, they prayed in their own language. I felt their attitude too. I felt the soul's attitude. And I didn't know what they were saying, but I felt what they were saying.
Well, you know what, Paula, and I think that I totally agree. We need to have a common language, and I think that language is probably going to end up being English, but just because it has so many words in it from other languages. But here's the thing: the book also says that we need development of a common language, and also we need a more multilinguists. And I don't believe though that all these other languages are going to just disappear. I think that even if we have a common language, I think there still will be. I don't think all these languages are all going to die. I think, especially now with things being preserved like they are on the internet, I think it's beautiful to hear people pray in different languages.
Oh man, that's why I asked you to do it, Kevin, because
unfortunately, in Japan, you know, a lot of the younger Japanese here. Well, of course, they're, you know, in Japan, of course, Japan is not a Christian country. So in the order of religions in Japan, so to speak, Christianity would probably come in, you know, very, very last. Because here we have, you know, like Shintoism, of course. We have, you know, Buddhism and some other different religions. But and then Christianity comes in like in fourth or fifth place or so. But the younger people today, they just, they have no religion in their life every day.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
They don't pray, they don't go to church, they don't even know God, really. And it's really sad because over here in Japan, this country has one of the highest suicide rates probably of any country in the world.
Oh,
and it happens here. You know, it happens here every day, and this is really a strange part. When most people usually do this, they decide to do it for some reason. They use the train lines to do it with, and of course, that's how people get back and forth to work over here, is by the train. So a lot of times you'll get on the train and you'll be headed to work, and then, you know, somebody happens to commit suicide, and it happens on your train. And then all of a sudden your train is stopped and delayed, and you have to, you know, and you're sitting there on the tracks for 4 and 5 hours, and you have to call in, and then you're late for work, of course. And, you know, so, but, yeah, that happens all the time. But
you know, Kevin, I've heard someone, by the way, how are we doing on time, Paula?
Well, before, we got about 8 minutes, I think, and I want to, just on that thought that Kevin just shared with us, it made me think of a quote from the Jesus Papers. And it's, again, midway or commentary, but they say, while the Eastern branch of the early Christian church, having its headquarters at Philadelphia, held more faithfully to the teachings of Jesus than did their Jerusalem brethren, it was regrettable that there was no one like Peter to go into China, or like Paul to enter India, where the spiritual soil was then so favorable for planting the seed of the new gospel of the kingdom. These very teachings of Jesus, as they were held by the Philadelphians, would have made such an immediate and effective appeal to the minds of the spiritually hungry Asiatic people, as did the preaching of Peter and Paul in the West. Isn't that an interesting quote? I mean, they're almost lamenting that there was no one to take Jesus' teachings into Asia and effectively, because the Asiatic mind was so ready for them. And I often wonder if it isn't still ready. They're such philosophical thinkers. And the Arantxa book kind of explores in depth the difference of having a philosophy, which is, you know, like I think at one point Jesus tells Ganad, the Jews have a God without a philosophy, and the Buddhists have a philosophy without a God. And you have to have, you know, you have to have that balance in order to create a holistic experience that's really meaningful.
Yeah, and that is true. Just very quickly, I did get an email from Anne, I think just yesterday, and it's just really sad. When I saw in the news from just this weekend what was happening in the United States. And it kind of shocked me, you know, because I'm not used to that over here in Japan anymore. Here in Japan, we don't have guns, of course, so we don't have situations like that happening over here. But I've seen something about the Fort Hood, Texas. There was a shooting there, and then something happened in Florida, I think, also. There was another shooting in Florida. I think, if we could just remember those people and just kind of, you know, make a prayer or have a short prayer, you know, for those people that were affected by that. And I just really hope something really positive comes out of all of that. And what I would really like to do is I think America, maybe I'm being a bit extreme here, maybe political, and I'm not trying to be, but I think, you know, America could do without guns. You just don't need them. I mean, if Japan, you know, Japan survives without it. So if Japan can do it, why not the States? I've had that question for years. I mean, if this country can do it, why can't America, you know, take a few hints and, I don't know, study, take, you know, learn some lessons from Japan.
I'll tell you what, Kevin. We will. How about if we do this? How about if we start a? How about if we start another blog talk radio show, and you and I can argue about guns for 2 hours? Because I don't think you should do it on this show.
yeah, that's true.
We're down to 2 minutes now, and
hey, you guys, why don't we do this? If you'd like, I can also. If you guys would be interested, I can pray in Ukrainian if you'd like.
I would like that. I would like to hear that.
Okay. I'll say it. We can say a prayer in Ukrainian here. Боже, ми дякуємо тобі, що ми маємо такий люксус, що мати таку програму чудову. Я дуже тобі дякую за товариші, що тут є, що тут говорить зі мною. I'm not very fluent in Ukrainian, but let's see if I can. І це так, як я сказав, чудовий люксус, що ми маємо цю програму. І я дякую тобі за всі ті товариші, всі ті брати і сестри, що тут слухають. І я молюся, щоб ти всі дав довгі життя тут на землі, і щоб вони всі були щасливі. І я молюся в ім'я Ісуса Христа. Амін.
Heavenly Father, thank you for Andre and Kevin, and thank you for all the wonderful souls that come and share their hearts and their minds with us on Saturday mornings. Please, Father, make our world a more peaceful world, a more loving world. Help us find our way through this darkness and the violence that we see happening on this world and the children that suffer and the families that suffer. Your children, they're your children, Father. Help us offer them comfort and peace. Help us do your work on this world, Father, and make this world as you would have it be, as above, so below. Give us the strength and the ability to do that, Father. That's what we ask. Thank you, Lord. Even so may it be. Amen.
And what a way to close our show. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And I just really appreciate everybody here. And again, it's been a great privilege. That's what I prayed for. I thank God for the privilege of being able to do this show and for all the brothers and sisters who are listening. And may you guys have all long and you all have long and happy lives here on Earth. Next week we're going to have Larry Mullins on the show. We've had him on the show before. He's going to talk about his new book on meta values. He's going to talk to us about what that means. So with that, we will see you next week. Thanks again for being with us.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
See everybody next week. Have a nice weekend.
Bye.
God bless you, brother.
God bless you.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. If you would like more information about the Urantia Book, or if you just have comments or questions, please feel free to email us at cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. That's cosmiccitizen@xnet.com. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.